This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. Outside, the sun is shining and there's about 6 inches of snow. It looks like a Christmas card. It is just pristine. It's beautiful out there, but very, very cold. Probably about -7, -8. I'm Mark Stephen. With me, about 40 miles to the north, probably equally frozen, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous day. Clear blue sky, snow everywhere. I was out with the dog this morning. It's just that childish satisfaction of seeing the different tracks in the snow. There was a badger, a fox, a squirrel. I was trying to work out what it was. I thought it was a rabbit, but it's a squirrel. And just so many different tracks out. It's brilliant in the moment.
Yeah. Our guest on the Scotland Outdoors podcast this week is a man who's very, very comfortable in the Scottish outdoors, David Balhary. David is Chief Executive of the John Muir Trust. It's a conservation charity dedicated to protecting and enhancing wild places.
He took up his role in January 2020 after completing a mountaineering trip to Patagonia with his son, climbing in the ice fields of South America. I feel inadequate already. Home to some of the most spectacular ice mushrooms. I don't know what an ice mushroom is.
No, we'll find out what ice mushrooms are later in the podcast. Welcome to the Scotland Outdoors podcast, David.
Thank you, Mark.
Describe what the conditions are like in Newton Moor, because, I mean, you are bang smack in the heart of the Highlands.
So the mist just lifted. We've got solid blue skies. And the sun is shining, it's crisp, we've had no fresh snow, and I've just had text from my son to say that up north the water's frozen.
There's aye something. Into every life a little rain must fall, or snow in this case. You took up your post as Chief Executive of the John Muir Trust at the end of January 2020. Now, just a couple of months later, we went into lockdown here in the UK due to COVID-19. Probably not the start to the new role that you might have envisaged. How did those first few months pan out?
I think really lucky for us. So when I came in, we were in the last year of a sort of a delivering a 3-year plan, and the trustees sort of made it clear that, you know, my initial role would be just to make sure that we delivered on target what had already been agreed. Fortunately, in that 2 months, I managed to get to meet most of the staff and round most of the properties, so I had a fair grounding on what was going on.
Summer last year, lockdown restrictions were easing and folk were going back to the countryside in big numbers. Well, they weren't treating the countryside with the respect that it should have. Did that impact on the trust properties?
Yes, there was a lot. So that came under the sort of the bracket of what you might call dirty camping. And my own home is up in Cannich. And obviously there's a honeypot there up the side of Glenafric. So I'd heard lots of stories about people camping and then took a couple trips up and just had a look round. And to be honest, the imagery that I saw was slightly different to the way that a lot of the media were picking up. So yes, there was a few more firestone circles than you'd normally see. There was a few more branches broken off trees. But what I saw was families who maybe hadn't had a chance to get out camping before. Some people sitting in a tent playing cards on the shores of the loch. Other people, there was a man walking with his son just trying to cast a bubble float in the water to see if they'd catch a fish. And what I felt was that, you know, there was a lot of people out there, higher numbers than we'd ever seen before. And there certainly were some bad apples in the mix, if you like. But the majority were just trying to get away and enjoy it in the best way they could.
How would you address that? Because it's basically an education issue, isn't it, mostly?
It's a huge education issue. And I think we've got to be very careful. Now, one of the things as I get older, I become increasingly aware of the privileges that I enjoyed in my youth. And anybody who's grown up in the Highlands has the same privileges. And it's very easy to look at people who have lived in an inner city life or haven't had those privileges and see them struggling in their first attempts to go out to the outdoors, camping or whatever, and then create a negative impression. I don't think it's about that. I think it's about being much kinder, looking at what their needs are and thinking strategically, I guess, in terms of, you know, Scotland's nature, its scenery, is one of our most valuable assets. So nature is the asset, and we need to realise that and put it at the centre of our rural economic engine. And then alongside that is to say, well, people need to come and see it. So we need the infrastructure that allows them to enjoy it and make that transition from whatever background they've got to being able to enjoy the outdoors. And the simple things, I mean, it's just like, you know, provision of public toilets in strategic areas and making sure those toilets are kept clean and that litter's cleared away. Because once litter starts to accumulate, then, you know, it just becomes a honeypot. There's more and more litter. But if you keep on top of it, then people lead by example, if you like. So people will follow the actions of others. And if it's tidy when they find it, the majority will leave it tidy when they leave.
Nigh on a year ago, when restrictions came in, we had a discussion amongst the team, and you know what we felt was we would like to carry on bringing the Scottish outdoors to folk around the world, because we thought it was important. You know, very often folk couldn't physically access it, so we would try and bring it to them. But that's a difficult balancing act, because you have to always remember that people are individuals. They react to it in different ways. You know, it means different things to different people. You can't be prescriptive when you say, go to the outdoors and you'll feel better. You might not.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. A sort of a classic criticism of people enjoying the outdoors is the campsite where there's lots of beer bottles left lying around and there's people enjoying a party and then they don't tidy it up afterwards. And I don't know if that relates directly to my childhood, but I can remember going through a stage in my life where I too went out and enjoyed a drink and had a party and so on. And it's certainly not, it's just to sort of recognise that none of us come from a background where we were entirely saints ourselves. So there is something about, I don't know, just helping people with that transition, I think, is my key point.
You mentioned your childhood there. I mean, you paint us a picture of it. Now, we should at this point say that your late father, Dick Balhary, was hugely respected naturalist and conservationist. I interviewed him a couple of times. Was he a big influence?
Oh, yeah, huge. I mean, I think father was a huge influence, but so was where I was brought up. So brought up in Kinlochhue, went to a school as a primary school where there was only 9 people in the whole school. I think I was the only boy for most of the time there. So that had a huge impact. And in terms of activities, I guess I led quite an introverted life. So spent most of the time in the hills fishing or pretending to stalk deer or just enjoying that connection with the outdoors, but in a very solitary sort of way. And then age 10, moved to Newton Moor, stayed there for 4 years. So got introduced to the world of shinty. That became a sort of a career focal point, as did at the time all the animals that father had. So whether it was foxes or pine martens or eagles or whatever. And then the whole issue about making sure there was enough food in the freezers to feed those animals. So I had lurchers and I spent a lot of time snaring rabbits and hares in the hill. So I kind of came from that lifestyle to went over to Aberdeenshire. And when I got to Aberdeenshire, partly, I guess, because of the transition from a small school to a situation in Badenoch where it was quite clear, I think, that I was going to be moving again shortly, that my attention on school studies became just a really low priority in my life. I never found schooling that easy. So when I went to Aberdeenshire, I think I spent probably more time away from school than I did at school. And then I think a big turning point for me was I was really fortunate. I went on an expedition organised by the British Schools Exploring Society and went to Greenland and spent a sort of summer in Greenland doing all sorts of things, a mixture of climbing and taking pictures and so on. And out of that experience, the big take-home message was that I was with people who were all going on to further education. And when I was at school, those that were going on to further education, I just looked at and I thought, you really are academic swats. You're the most uninteresting people. And I really don't want to be part of that. I don't aspire to be part of your group. But in Greenland, the people that were there from all over the UK were absolutely inspiring. And I thought, you've been slow to mature, Dave, and you need to pick your game up and go back to Scotland and put the time in that you need now to... So I'd left school at 6 year, but with very little qualifications, having tried time and time again to get various hires and O-levels. But then coming back from Greenland, realising that I needed now to focus on at least getting the minimum to scrape in to do the course I wanted to do, which was at Aberdeen.
How did you make good that shortfall?
Night school. So support from my parents, giving me the support for the extra chance to do a bit of night school, do a bit of going to, it was a commercial college in Aberdeen to reset those hires for the third time, some of them.
Yeah, for a late maturing non-academic, you did okay. You left university with a PhD in the ecology of pine martens, and you moved on to research the Scottish Wildcat for the Nature Conservancy Council. You had one particular epiphany moment going up the A9. Tell me about it.
So I got stuck in traffic, and I'd been doing research on the Scottish Wildcat, funded by the public purse, looked at everything that there was to look at about Scottish wildcats. So whether it was their, what they call the pelage characteristics, or the stripy markings, or whether it was to do with their skull shape and size, or whether it was to do with their length of their intestines, or their DNA, or whatever. We basically had concluded all this research and looked at what the options were for the future of Scotland's wildcat. And I'd presented that to my superiors at the time. And with great delight, my line manager looked at me and had said to me, "You've missed an option." And I remember looking at him in my gung-ho attitude, I thought, no, I haven't. There's absolutely no way I've missed any option. That's the best piece of research I've done. I've been really well supported by everybody around about. There's no way we've missed an option. And then he looked at me with a wry smile and he said, "Aye, you've missed the do-nothing option." And I thought, wow, so there we are. We spent all that taxpayers' money on finding out what the problem was, identifying its cause and the solutions, and somebody in a policy position is saying that the best course of action is to do nothing. And, I mean, it wasn't quite criminal, but it was crushing in terms of being a scientist and giving advice to government in that interface. So that was absolutely pivotal for me. And then the connection to the being in the A9 was I was sitting there reflecting on that story as I looked out the window. And I saw all these plastic tubes at the side of the road. Those are known as chuli tubes. They're sort of the guards that they use to protect trees from rodents and deer and so on to get them an early start in life. And I thought, well, Mr. Chuli, whoever he was, had a massive impact on afforestation in Scotland. And what I need to do now is to make a career shift from the science environment into that strategic policy world where I can make more of an impact. And then when somebody comes to me with, you know, good science, I can look at it and hopefully I'm not the one that says that the best choice now is do nothing.
But you really followed that through, didn't you? Because you've very influential, high-profile roles at the Deer Commission for Scotland, the Crofters Commission, Rewilding Britain before joining the John Muir Trust. You were at the Scottish Government looking at rural policy. You get the impression you're not a desk-bound person, but you were really at the heart of decision-making.
I think you just become, when you go into sort of policy-making Scottish Government, you just become a very small cog in a very big wheel. But it is exciting, and there is a sense of the people who are making policies and giving advice to ministers, there's so much information out there that it's difficult for them to know how to process all that, where to put the emphasis and where the solutions lie. And ultimately what happens is that they end up listening to stakeholder bodies and it becomes a very sectoral sort of debate. Whereas I think if you've lived in the Highlands all your life, you look at the rural landscape, it doesn't apply just to the Highlands, I'm sure it's the same in the Lake District or in the Peak District or whatever, is that you don't see it in sectors. You see how the whole thing works together. And then you see a sort of a need for a lot of small changes, but almost the missing part being, well, where's the strategic vision that we need? And I guess for me, I've been hugely influenced by some of Jim Hunter's writings. Not only his writings, but some of his sort of core philosophies that people in rural areas really value those rural areas. None of them are out to destroy them or to do any harm. They just live a lifestyle that's a consequence of the economic incentives that are built round about them. So where we're going, I guess, is what we really need is a resilient economy, one that doesn't depend on the vagaries of what the latest government policy is or whether we're in Europe or out of Europe or whether there's a wealthy landowner that owns the land or all those things. What's needed is, at the core of it, a much more stable economic base. And that's why I think that Scotland's natural assets are the key to that. And I guess another turning point for me was reading Jim Hunter's book, which is called The On the Other Side of Sorrow, where he talks about the arrival of the whole SSSI system into the UK. and how it alienated people on the land away from assets that they had really valued, and it became a sort of a them-us culture. And I guess now looking at it, you sort of say, well, take an area like sort of the Northwest, and you look at the businesses there that are based around tourism, or even not around tourism, but any of the private businesses, most of them will promote their business using logos or references to the natural assets that surround them. So there's the pride's there. It's just giving them ownership and giving them the help and the ability to create a resilient economy round about it.
Does that them and us situation still exist? Because I've spoken to advisors in the Scottish Government who'd never been north of Perth in about 10 years. It's a big problem.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite... It's them us is just... It sort of polarises it too quickly. I mean, if I was honest, when I worked in Scottish Government, I'd probably... I couldn't have worked harder. And some of those colleagues round about me who were working in that policy space were working equally hard. So you can't fault their effort or the energy they put in. It's just that there's only so many hours in the day, and some of them don't have the benefit of that background of living in rural areas. And I guess one frustration that's always existed for my employers has always been that I've kind of, I guess it's as strong as to say, I've refused to move out of the Highlands as my residential home. So even when working in Edinburgh, I just commuted or sought to what they'd call hot desk from Inverness. But I believe that, you know, those connections are just vital to making creative policy solutions that work for people in rural areas.
I've watched this with interest for 20 years now, that, you know, that there is a different weight given to different types of knowledge. So, you know, you've got people actually living in an area, living on the land, living with the everyday experience of a particular ecology. And that's regarded as being less weighty than a scientist who's maybe visited it a few times, taking some measurements and what have you. But, you know, they're saying, yes, but we've got data-based knowledge. You know, their knowledge is just anecdotal. It's different types of knowledge, but they can have absolutely equal value.
They can, but, you know, to be honest, I don't think that either holds the key to the solution. So if you ask people in the Highlands what they need and what they would like, their initial reaction is going to be a reference back to what they've had in the past and to the systems that they know, because they've never been given the opportunity to think into that creative space. So if you can't have what you had in the past, so for example, Victorian sporting estates. So a lot of people that I play shinty with that are colleagues and friends work in that world of the Victorian sporting estate, whether it's through deer management or grousemer management or rearing pheasants or whatever. And you look at it and you look at the changes in society. You look at the stuff that David Attenborough does on Blue Planet. You look at the acceptability of shooting tigers or whatever. And you say, actually, society is now changing, that the whole concept of trophy, either in terms of the size of the animal, the rareness of the animal, or the number of that animal that you shoot, all those concepts they're not really the things that you're going to raise in open company in an urban area anymore. Or, you know, in many ways, not just even an urban area, just society's changing, its values have changed. So when people now look at how you might use these vast rural areas that Scotland's got, those activities still exist. So if you sort of drill down and you say, right, so what you're saying, David, is that the culture of the Highland stalker is no more because he's part of the Victorian era. And I say, no, that's not what we're saying at all. What we're saying is that the skill sets that stalkers hold are kind of second to none. I mean, can you imagine taking somebody out in the midges in the pouring rain for 8 hours up and down the hillside and then getting them back to the larder, whether they've shot a stag or not, and they feel that they've had a great day? Yes, there's some skills round about the stalking element, but there's interpersonal skills there that are second to none. I mean, most private companies would crave to have those interpersonal skills on their team. And then beyond that, the deer population in Scotland is, you know, if you look at some of the denuded landscapes, the fact that Scotland and the UK really doesn't have a montane woodland at all. We don't have a natural tree line. We're probably unique in the world at not having a very key component of our natural heritage. And we don't have it because we've got some of the highest deer densities. And those deer densities have been driven by the Victorian sporting estate model. And the deer numbers need to come down. So in that world of deer numbers coming down, you need stalkers. You need the best stalkers that you've got. And you need people who are motivated to maintain deer at much lower density, but deer in much better health. Deer that live in their natural environment, that have access to woodland and shelter and food in the wintertime. So these snows just now, Scotland's deer population, there are very few of them, have got access to decent food and shelter in these conditions, simply because the model of the past has had such high grazing pressure that no trees have been allowed to grow.
How do you convince people? Because, you know, I've spoken to stalkers, Mark's spoken to stalkers, and I get the feeling it's very much it's them and thus, and the only game in town is on the Victorian shooting model, and they don't see it, the fact that, yeah, they've got transferable skills, but how do you make that happen? Glenn Fesci springs to mind, where they actually made some really hard decisions to change the model, and I would say it's worked. I don't know, what's your thoughts?
In terms of the response in the woodland in the main glen, in Glen Fesci, it's staggering and it's there for everybody to see. So the habitat response is there. The habitat response worked. That's just a given. The bit that hasn't happened yet, though, is that the stalking, traditional stalking community still feels that what happened in Glen Fesci was a challenge to them, and it created the them-us thing, and it created ecologists against stalkers or whatever. I just think that the discussion is far more nuanced than that. The idea of controlling deer at much lower densities is going to take more stalking effort, not less. And there needs to be more appreciation for the skills that are on display when people control deer at low density.
That kind of discussion, David, what's the correct forum for it? Because, you know, frequently in mainstream media, you can see it is deliberately polarised.
Yeah, so I don't think you can have effective discussion without trust. So the first thing is that you need to create space within which people actually feel that their voice can be heard and listened to. And in the initial stages of those discussions, they will want to argue the defence of the Victorian state model. And it's that you have to hear out the argument. And then you have to then sort of say, well, okay, but ultimately, how long can that continue for? I mean, does anybody really believe that these high deer densities that actually affect, you know, ultimately affects things like carbon sequestration? So the whole issue about the global climate change, the Victorian estate model, it affects that. And the stalkers can see that. They can see the arguments. What they're fighting to protect is their culture and their way of life and their income and their family home and their tied house. And the way out is to say that it's not just a theoretical option that's on the other side, but there is actually a practical option. And there's your house, there's your annual salary, and there's your job. And with that goes status, where you're appreciated by everybody in society as doing a job. So, you know, culturally, the Highland Stalker was held on a pedestal as being somebody to look up to be respected in that model. The fear is that in terms of the change that's coming, their role in society is in some way diminished. And I don't see that at all. I see that their role and their status can be easily protected. What's not clear yet is the path from where they are just now to this sort of, you know, this model. And if you take the likes of Anders Paulsen or some other of the big estate owners, what they're showing with their own private income is, yes, we can show the path to that. So that's fine if you work for one of those types of landowners, but that doesn't work for everybody. So where it's in the public interest, how's it going to be funded? You know, is it just going to be that if you own land in Scotland, you've got rights and responsibilities? And a consequence of that is that if you can't afford to control the deer at a low enough density that allows for carbon to be captured, well, then maybe there's a question mark as to whether you can afford to own the land or not. Is it that way that we go? Or is the other way to say, well, okay, so that transition period, is there an argument in there that that transition can be assisted with public money. And that's where the interesting debates are. But you've got to get through the cultural issues before you get onto those debates.
You mentioned the carbon tax there. Maybe explain that in a bit more detail. But there's a sort of feeling that there's big changes coming. That process is beginning.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you raised a really interesting point at the start, is that, you know, what was the impact of the COVID situation and coming into the job? The COVID example showed us that huge societal changes can take place very quickly. And I think that's what we're going to see in terms of the whole carbon issue. If you take the American elections, the fact that America's coming back into caring and showing that it wants to be part of the global climate change debate is huge. And then that's going to impact on everything we do. So the transition from where we are just now, so Scottish Government has given us our commitment to net zero by 2045. You can debate the niceties of using language like net zero. At the Trust, we use more like carbon credible, because there will always be a need to emit carbon in some way or another. It's just how you balance it. So I think there'll be big changes, even for ourselves, at John Muir Trust, to becoming very carbon credible, and how we go about doing that. And in all of that, I think there's a key question, which is that rising levels of carbon dioxide on the planet is not something new. I mean, it is in our lifetime, or the last few generations, but at the millions of years that the planet's been around, it's not new. And the planet is superbly designed to capture carbon. So the issue is what, Scottish context, what is it that prevents it capturing carbon? And we all know that trees sequester and that peatland in good health captures carbon and stores carbon. So, and we know that the planet's trying to do that, it's trying to capture carbon. So maybe another way is to say, well, what's in society's interest here? Is it that you allow the planet and our landscape to capture carbon, or is it that you manage that landscape for another interest? So if you take grouse moors, for example, or sports shooting of grouse, whose interest is that? It's a very niche interest. A very small number of people benefit from that. Whereas actually, it could be that society benefits from carbon being captured. And then that gets to a core, really critical debate in terms of, well, when you own land, are you allowed just to manage that land with disregard to the impacts on wider society? Or is there actually some sort of moral responsibility at the core of land ownership that says, well, yes, you can own land, but there's a reasonable expectation that you manage that land in a way that captures carbon. So every bit of land can capture a different amount of carbon. And if you say, well, that's the baseline, then somebody who for very personal interests, or for interests that are not those of wider society, decides to manage in a way that limits that carbon capture to 1/10 of its potential, let's say, well, then maybe that's a choice that they can make. So government could either license that activity and say, well, yep, you can buy a license for us to do that, or we just tax. And I think these are the big debates that we're going to have to look at going forward, because consequence of COVID and everything is that we're going to go possibly into quite a deep recession. So we've got to make best use of public money. And maybe there isn't an expectation to pay everybody to capture carbon. Maybe some people need to look at it another way and say, well, actually, society expects you to manage the land in a way that captures carbon. If you choose not to, then that opens up a question as to whether that's taxable. So in the same way that cigarettes are taxable, you say, well, you know, that damages health, so we need to pay for the health service.
You said earlier that you've been kind of a pain in the backside to lots of your bosses because you refuse to move out of the Highlands. Community is important to you. It's something you're very keen to hang on to, that identity, and to explore in your role at the John Muir Trust. There's an initiative called Northwest 2045. Explain that to me.
So first of all, it's a geographic area, and it's roughly from Ullapool north to Betty Hill, the very northwest corner of Scotland, if you like. And it's an area that if you look at some sort of metrics about population there, they've got lower than average salary. The age structure is very skewed towards an elderly population. There's quite alarming emigration, so the population's declining. And you sort of say, well, we've got lots of people looking at policy development as it applies to the whole of Scotland. And it's not quite one size fits all, but you kind of need to develop a more nuanced approach. And the Scottish Government's just recently come out with this idea of sort of rural land use partnerships. And again, with the rural land use partnership approach, they're sort of saying the Highlands is one area. But then you sort of look at the Highlands and you look at the different issues in different parts of the Highlands. There's no way one size fits all there. So the idea of the Northwest 2045 was to be aware of the other initiatives that are going on in government and saying, yes, government will be listening. Let's hope it's listening. And can we get a collective voice? Can we work with local people to say, look, you do have an opportunity to express yourselves. There's lots of things that you won't agree on. So just park those, but try and identify the things that you do agree on and speak with a collective voice back to government and say, if you could do just three or four things to help the Northwest, this is what it would be. And government would say, well, what are your targets? And so then I'd say back to the people up there, well, let's work that out. What do you collectively want? And when I say you collectively, it's the people who live there and have their businesses there and who own land there and who rear their children there, if you like. It's those voices that you need to hear in a collective. And at the moment, I think, in terms of most of my experience with communities, is that you have a few voices that speak very loudly. But whether they genuinely represent the community, you know, community is a funny word. Community is like, you imagine that there is this thing of a community. But in the Highlands, I think the only time you really get strong communities is when you seek to change something that everybody agrees is a bad idea. Then they'll coalesce together to fight whatever that is. But generally speaking, the communities are very diverse. There's lots of different people in there. And some people speak loudly and other people speak with a very soft voice. And some people are never heard. And the idea is that could we have a process or could we help work with other people, whether it's the community buyouts or it's the community companies or the landowners or the businesses or the local authority or whatever, the councillors, work with everybody to try and find a way, a process that when you've gone through that process, everybody says, yeah, that's what we've agreed. That is our collective voice. That's not just the spokesperson, but that's what we think. So it might be that they aspire to say, well, actually, we want to reverse this rural depopulation that's going on. We're not saying we want to turn it into a conurbation and industrialise the landscape, but we are saying we would maybe like 30%, 50% more people than what we have today to get back to some point. And then that way our schools begin to work. We don't have to close our primary schools. And it could be that you want to say something like the average salary, rather than being well below the national average, is about the national average. Then you sort of say, well, how could you make that happen easily? And again, I go back to the COVID. You know, home working is fantastic. So if you can home work in an area that has some of the finest natural assets in Europe, then people would love to work there. They just need access to housing, they need access to really good broadband, and they need a reasonable road network to allow that to happen. So, you know, these are just ideas. I can't speak on behalf of that collective voice, but those are the types of idea that the Northwest 2045 is trying to push.
These are really exciting ideas, David. And, you know, we could talk about some of those ideas and the land reform all day. In fact, Mark and I do talk about land reform all day. But we heard at the start there about the trip you made to Patagonia at the end of 2019 with your son to the ice fields. How did that come about?
When I was young, father was doing the Golden Eagle Eyrie Survey. So I was always climbing in and out of eyries to look at either the prey items that were in the nest or how many eggs were there or whatever, when you couldn't see in, so they could look at breeding success. So I had an affinity with climbing, but not with the technicalities of it. So the rope work and so on was not that familiar with to me, but picked it up. But then, like many climbers, I guess, you get to a stage where you're involved in a few serious accidents and your mortality comes to the fore. And you have children of your own, so you back off for a while. So I went through that stage. And then my sons, when they were younger, got really interested in climbing, and both of them are quite reasonable climbers. And I remembered from my youth seeing, at the time, there was a guy called Messner had climbed this mountain in South America called Cerritore. It's just a big granite spire with a great big snow mushroom on top of it. And I looked at it and I thought, well, first of all, I've never seen anything like that anywhere in all the mountain books I've read. So it's unique. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. And I thought it'd be impossible to ever climb it, but it'd be nice to see it. And I'd expressed that to one of my sons, and he said, well, why don't we climb it? And I thought, well, you know what? At the age I am now and how stiff and old I feel, I think that's just impossible. So he convinced me, anyway, that there was enough innate in there to give it 2 years of really hard training. Just trained really basically in the Scottish climbing scene for 2 years. Got my skills sort of set back up, got my fitness as good as it could be. And then we set off to do what is, and I make no bones about it, it's probably the easiest route on Cerritore. It's called the Ragni route. And by easy, it's still incredibly hard. But the ultimate, you've got a headwall to go through, which is sort of four pitches of steep climbing. But the exciting part of the whole climb is to climb through these mushrooms. So the mushrooms are formed by rime ice. And I know for those of us who are lucky to walk in the highlands or up in the mountains in the wintertime, you'll see that these feathers of rime begin to form on rocks where you've got moist air gathering. And in effect, it's that process taken to an absolute extreme as the moist air blows across the Patagonian ice cap and then hits these really high granite spires. This rime builds up and builds up and builds up, and it forms mushrooms. And then the wind hits the cliffs below and blows tunnels up through the rime mushrooms. As a climber, the golden ticket, if you like, is to climb up through one of these ice tunnels. But you're climbing with a sort of kilometre and a half of exposure below you on fixing, or yeah, your safety's not great, so you're relying basically on your belays. So you've got good belays, but trying to fix ice screws into, or snow stakes as it is some of the time, into these ice mushrooms isn't the best protection out, so you're likely to take a whipper. Anyway, bottom line was we didn't get a chance to get that far just because the weather window didn't open up. And I think that the first people to climb Cerritore in the year we were there climbed in the week after we got back to Scotland, which was unfortunate. I think there was about 40 people got to the summit of Cerritore because there was the most amazing weather window opened up. And Cerritore in the right weather conditions is doable and reasonably safe. It's desperately dangerous in the wrong weather conditions. So, you know, it gets down to, it's not high altitude climbing, it's only sort of just over 10,000 feet. Your biggest risk is obviously poor weather, which brings on avalanche or rockfall. And if you play the right head game, then you should stay reasonably safe.
You want to have another go at it?
I'd love to, yeah. I'd absolutely love to. I've got to watch, I've got a huge awareness of the carbon footprint that takes to get down there. And that's something that I need to look at for the rest of my life, the carbon budget that I want to enjoy and what my aspiration is to be able to walk the walk, if you like. But that aside, it took quite a while. It took probably 6 months just to come to terms with not getting to the top after training so hard. But yeah, the size of the, put it this way, the size of the climbing gym at home is getting bigger. And I'm beginning to huff and puff again with some training in mind, so.
David, it's been a real pleasure speaking to you. It's fascinating, ranging across a whole sort of array of topics there. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us on the Scotland Outdoors podcast.
Not at all. Nice to speak to you both. It was really good. Thank you.
Such a breadth of knowledge there, Ewan.
I was just kind of, so much to tink in. You know, the whole debate about land reform, the whole point about getting communities having a say, and then getting a horrible picture of being scared senseless and some of these mushrooms with nothing beneath you. I don't fancy it at all.
Anyway, from myself, Mark Stephen, him, Ewan McElraith, and David Balhari, thank you very much for downloading this podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.